Hello, everyone. This is Rory welcoming you back to another episode of Security Confidential, filling in today for Manoj. Our guest today is Richard Hollis. Richard is the founder and chief executive officer of Risk Crew. He is a seasoned cybersecurity professional and ardent privacy rights advocate who possesses over 30 years of hands-on skills and experience in designing, implementing, and testing the security integrity of business information technology systems. He lives and breathes cybersecurity and understands how to simplify it and make it relevant. Richard, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Roy, for having me. Yeah. And thanks for that wonderful intro.
Absolutely.
The season part you referred to is salt. It's salty. No pepper, just all salt at my age.
Thanks for having me. Absolutely. Thank you for being here. So I guess let's just get into a little bit about you. You know, what's your story? What's your background? And how'd you get to where you're at now?
My story, my background. It's a long story. I'm an old guy. I've been in cybersecurity for well over 30 years. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I was working for the government as a physical security expert, bypassing locks and alarms and CCTVs and whatnot. And then I did that in Washington, D.C. for years and years. And then suddenly, computers started to be more and more attractive to me, so I took a side note and got into what is now cybersecurity. It wasn't called that at the time. I don't think it was called IT security at first, but it's gone through a lot of changes. But no, I've been around a long time. I started, like I said, started with government and then into computer security with the government, and then took a job in the private sector and came over to Europe and did that for a while. And I started a company over in London. It's called Risk Crew, and no products, just things like risk assessments and security penetration testing, red team testing, you know, breaking into systems and things like that. And I've had the company now for 20 some years, I think. Okay. We're located in London and we're having a blast doing it. It's a great, you know, times are exciting to be in cybersecurity. It wasn't that sexy when I first started, but now everybody's talking about cyber. But when I was there, you know, nobody would recognize you if you're sitting in the back of a room. And if you had something to say, nobody really wanted to hear it. I started the company right around the dot-com boom, you know, when it was all e-commerce. And nobody thought about security for e-commerce platforms. So, we're always like, the industry is always a step behind a technology breakthrough or some sort of, you know, burst in whether it's technology or e-commerce, ways to make money on the internet. So I always felt like I was in the shadows of some big star right before me, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That's cool. I mean, so did you start the company then specifically for e-commerce services to service that industry?
We started back in like 2000, 2001, we started in London. And at the time, the only buyers for what's now known as penetration testing were banks, you know, large, who were doing financial transactions or, you know, online banking. And so we were early founders of OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project, in the UK. And, you know, the game was on an application level. So we started doing application penetration testing. But, you know, technically, the market was banks. Very, very few e-commerce providers, came along and did it. And then regulation came along, standards and regulation came along, like PCI, payment card industry, that, you know, mm-hmm. mandated doing pen testing of transactional websites. So we started out as a web app pen testing company and then got into, you know, risk frameworks like ISO 27001 or whatnot, and then moved on into, you know, it, as the market matured and there was a bigger call for the fundamentals like risk assessments and supply chain risk management, things like that, security awareness training. But so that's it. We're a smaller company. We'll always have been, probably always will be. Half of us are, you know, geeky pen testers. The other half are song and dance guys like me who do risk assessments. But it's a lot of fun. And like I said, product agnostic.
Yeah, that's very cool. When you're talking about pen testing, do you guys do it manually or do you use automated pen testing tools and stuff like that to help you along?
No, it's all manual. It's all, okay. It's all manual. There is pen testing has become really, commoditized, as you know.
Yep.
You can get a free pen test out there and just log into sites that it's a long time. We started the business for a very sophisticated customer, like a bank who understood the benefits from manual security penetration testing. So we've always been in that. We do manual, like to do it on site, so we've got knowledge transfer, and we can sit next to somebody and then show them exactly what we're doing and how easy it is to exploit a vulnerability.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we're picking up, Rory, the fun is doing things like red team testing and not just looking for vulnerabilities in technology, but in people and process as well, and getting on site and social engineering. It's a blast. And that is now, that at one time that was a sophisticated client. Now that's starting to be seen as a much better way to do what is called penetration testing, a more holistic view of how do I bypass, all the security controls that I'm relying on to protect my data.
And I think you hit a key point there with pen testing, is that it's a lot more of what the security tool limit is, and more so what is the actual limit of the user, and how you can manipulate them to get what you want. Because in real life, that's the angle that they're going to take 9 times out of 10. It's going to be trying to beat the human, not beating the technology.
Oh God, yeah, that's what everybody's, everybody puts their money in technology and always have been. Of course, our industry promotes that by this firewall, this IDS, this IPS.
It's a product. Everything's a product.
Exactly. Buy this product, and year after year, they're spending more and more and more on product, and they still, and every year after year after year, there's more and more and more breaches, and they just haven't put two together. a threat actor is going to take the path of least resistance, and if that's through a person rather than a firewall, that's the way they're going to go. So it's odd that we just don't seem to learn that. We're driven. Our market, our market is driven by cybersecurity product marketers who tell us, cybersecurity equals this thing that I want to sell you. One of the best things I do is, or perspectives I have in a company is I go to a company and if they can tell me that, there's three attack vectors to any business. It's people, process, and technology. Right. I say, great. Do you split your security budget a third on you and spend a third on people, a third on process, and a third on technology? Oh, no, it's all of it spent on technology. And right there, that they're neglecting 2 out of 3 attack vectors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
No, that's right on. I mean, it's funny you say people, process, technology, because I've, between Manoj and myself here at Dark Rhino, we've talked about those three things ad nauseum. As far as, our approach to cybersecurity and what we're trying to do. And your point about it being a product, it's exactly that. Cybersecurity is no longer the best tool has market dominance. It's the best marketing, the highest budget has market dominance, whatever, people hear about, know about. And then, that affects certain industries for sure. But it's definitely affected this one.
It's, okay. Rory, I'm an old guy, as you can see by the color of my hair. I've been around for a long time, and you know what? I'm at that point in my profession where I look back and I'm really disappointed with the cybersecurity industry. Our product vendors, our managed security, service providers, our internet service providers. We have all done a terrible, terrible job. Our product vendors, they sell us products that frankly don't work. They don't work. Cybersecurity products don't work. And it's odd that, that we, whether that's, malware is probably the best example, ransomware. Everybody's, oh my God, ransomware is a problem. Ransomware. What is ransomware? Ransomware is malware. Do you know anybody who's not running anti-malware software on their, on their devices? At least 2 or 3? No, but we never say, hey, the ransomware problem might be a proof that, our anti-malware vendors are letting us down.
Right.
Because it's malware that's not being, so you look at and see these obvious examples where our products just aren't fit for purpose.
Yeah.
All right. They were fit for purpose for a threat 3 or 4 years ago. But by the time, you know, when a vendor puts his R&D into an IDS or an IPS or a sandbox or some kind of, you know, newfangled, high, sexy technology and sells it to us, that was a threat from years ago. But right. They're going to leave it on the market until they get the money back. And anyway, I'm probably with you guys more than you understand, because I look at our industry today and I don't take a lot of pride in the quality that we've settled for. You know, we seem to year after year, like I said, we spend more money, we buy more products and the products don't work. We have breaches and we respond to breaches by spending more on product. It's a circle of failure as far as I'm concerned.
So what's step one then to simplify this, reverse this trend? What do organizations need to do?
Well, here's what, you know, you and I, we would go out and buy a flat screen TV. We take it home. It doesn't work. What would you do?
Return.
You'd take it back. Mm-hmm. You'd take it back to the vendor and say, I'm sorry, this doesn't work. But no, we buy a firewall, and a firewall is supposed to prevent specific traffic going through a port. And if it doesn't, do we take it back and say, I'm sorry, I bought your product to stop traffic through certain ports and it doesn't work. I'd like my money back, please. So I think it all starts with, you know, I know I've got my brother will send back his Coke at a restaurant if it doesn't have enough ice in it or if it has too much ice in it. You know, if we started to actually practice, you know, a certain consumer, requirement for excellence in our own industry. And when things don't work, we send them back. That would be step one. But our product vendors, our service providers bear absolutely no accountability and no liability. All right. We have a breach. Like I said, ransomware, we have a breach. Why don't we pick up the phone and call our anti-malware vendor and say, I'd like my money back, please. I just got ransomware.
Right.
And can you cover my cost? Cause it's, you know, cause the impact has been X.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no connection between what we buy and customer satisfaction in this industry. And I just don't get that, Rory. You know, I get cranky when I say salty. I'm really cranky. So I think it all starts with us.
Yeah.
You know, we have settled for crap in the cybersecurity industry. We buy stuff. It doesn't work. We say nothing. We just buy more stuff.
Right.
And you know what else I'd point out to you? It's things that we don't talk about in our industry include, you know, cybersecurity vendors profit from the insecurity of computing. Uh-huh. Let me say that again, because I'm a bit of a drama queen. Cybersecurity vendors profit from the insecurity of our computers, period. It's like the pharmaceutical industry who makes a lot of money selling us, you know, pills for our sneezes and sniffles and you know, all our viruses and our infections and all the things that bug us. And you got to wonder, I mean, they make so much money treating the symptoms that, you know, that seems in our industry, nobody's looked at, you know, the cure.
Right.
And if it was, would we buy it? Would they sell it to us?
Yeah.
Because there's so much money in treating the symptoms.
No, I'd agree with you. This is the classic doctor model. You know, a patient cured is a customer loss, right?
Yeah,
so you gotta keep them coming back for more. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact too that the powerhouses in this industry, it's been a norm to keep this so kind of maybe shadowy is the right word, where it's hard for the normal person, your average individual, to really understand technology, cybersecurity, and all that from just looking at it plainly. And unless you're an expert, you're in this field, you might not have the best grasp on what you actually need and what it's actually supposed to do. It's like with your Coke example. I know how Coke's supposed to taste. If it doesn't taste right, I'll send it back. But if I don't understand how this antivirus is supposed to work or how this firewall is supposed to work, if it doesn't work right, then maybe I think it might be my own fault. And I think if we as a population were to be more educated and more understanding of, okay, I know how this is supposed to work and I can identify when it's not working correct, you'd have a lot more vendors who would be held accountable by their customers because they would know something's wrong.
You know, I agree with maybe half of that, Rory, because I know when I turn on, I don't know anything about flat screen TVs, but if I turn it on, it doesn't work or the picture's always fuzzy. I know it's, you know, just like I don't know a lot about firewalls, but if I turn it on and traffic still comes through that shouldn't come through, and I bought an IDS and I have a breach and it didn't detect it, mm-hmm. and it's called an intrusion detection system,
right.
I don't have to be a techie geek to know, hey, maybe I bought the wrong IDS. No, I bought something to detect intrusions, and I've got an IDS that I spent X for, and it doesn't work. Yeah. I agree with you that there's a certain amount of, and vendor products are filled with, you know, we buy them out of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Be afraid, yeah. be very afraid. And there's all these, you know, the overstatements and they're hyped up to us in marketing terms that, you know, what's a next generation, you know, antivirus? What's that? You know, what's a multi-generation? Is that some sort of antivirus tool from 20 years ago plus this? You know, we purposely shroud these products in this speak that confuses everybody. Right. But at the end of the day, either the firewall works or it doesn't. Either the intrusion detection works or it doesn't. Either the anti-malware is very, very simple. You buy an anti-malware and you get malware. I'm sorry, what else do you have to say other than pick up the phone, call the vendor and say, did I configure this wrong? Did you configure this wrong? Here's one of the biggest tests I always have before I work with customers who say, should I buy X? And I say, hey, let's go to Google and type in vendor X's name and see if they've been breached. Hmm. Because you know what, Rory, the top 20 vendors in our industry who sponsor all the conferences that you and I go to and, you know, underwrite all they spend billions of dollars marketing their services. Top 20 have all been breached in the last 18 months.
Right.
The top, name them. And you see this, and you think, whoa, don't they use their own products? RSA loses their code to hackers. I'm sorry. And so we all got to buy another RSA encryption product because the RSA encryption. Fortinet, SonicWall, read the papers every day. Our cybersecurity vendors are getting hacked by threat actors. And these are trusted. These are our trusted products. These are the products we buy to secure our systems.
Right.
They've now become threat vectors of choice for cyber criminals because they know we count on those SonicWalls and those, you know, and those Fortinet firewalls and RSA's encryption and our own and. So they don't even practice what they preach. My point is they're not leaders, they're not shepherds. They're sheep. They're just as lost as we are.
Right.
You know, they can't protect their own systems, and they're selling us things that we're buying to protect ours. And if you just look, it's right there. It's right in plain sight. And the best way to do that before you go out and buy a cybersecurity product, go to Google and say, has that vendor been hacked in the last any? And see if they've been breached, and then ask the vendor about that. I'm sorry, don't you use your own IDS to protect your own company systems because your business has been breached?
Right.
And that's what I mean as consumers. We're not smart enough to connect those dots. We're buying very expensive things that if they don't work have a dire impact on our businesses. And so the basic due diligence of before we buy a firewall or antivirus or intrusion detection or whatever it is we're going to buy, an encryption product, by going out and say, have they lost this encryption algorithm before? Have they been hacked? Yeah. You know, and just seeing, do they know something that I don't before I buy their product? And ask them about that. You know, you're buying an IDS. This is what I'm talking about. Do you guys use that IDS? Has it ever been part of a breach? Has that IDS ever been part of a customer breach that you're aware of? And if so, why? Because of bad configuration? Because of, and this is what's lacking as consumers. We don't extend the same, you know, requirement for excellence that we do on everything else we buy, from flat screen TVs to telephone watches to gym memberships.
Right.
You know, if it doesn't work, why is it that our industry doesn't complain about it? And doesn't do basic due diligence? What is it about the cybersecurity industry that makes it exempt from consumer satisfaction?
Yeah, if I had to guess, I said,
I'm being rhetorical there.
No,
Rory,
I know. I believe me, I'm right with you. I do think though it comes to that. Cybersecurity is perceived as being a very technical man's game, right? You have to understand this and that and the other thing. But if you break that down like you just did, You know, if people had that broken down for them, business owners had that broken down for them to say, hey, this is what it's supposed to do. If it doesn't do this, it's junk. Return it. If they had that mindset, I think
if
a lot,
it doesn't
it'd be
meet
changed.
The objective, right? The
right.
objective of the product is supposed to do X. Like I buy a car. I don't know anything about cars, especially these days. When I was a kid, I could, you know, pop a hood and start. Yeah, nowadays. Yeah, but I'm saying you jump in a car, you turn the key, and it doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
What else do you need to know?
Yeah.
It either meets the requirement of the, you know, a firewall, anti-malware. These are very simple concepts here to keep malware off of our device. So once you get malware, what else do you need to know other than, did I do something wrong? Did, you know, was it misconfigured? Is it a user problem? You know, please, Mr. Vendor, can you explain to me how I got malware when I just paid you X for something called anti-malware? So I agree. I take your point, and you're absolutely right, Rory. You know, there's a technical competence, maybe, but at the end of the day, it's just consumer satisfaction.
Yeah.
How many firewalls need to get breached before we understand? Is there any? What is it? You know, a really good example I think I have is like, you know, security incident and event management tools, SIM tools, right?
Right. Yep.
You know, and we're sold this idea of false positives.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we got SOCs and we're monitoring SIMs, and there's false positive. There's a false positive. There's a false. I'm sorry. What is a false positive? Why don't we call it what it is? It's a false alert. It's not positive. It's not negative. You got to get off your backside and go investigate it. All right?
Right.
And do you know that the industry average is 40% false positive for any SIM product out there?
Wow.
Now that means 4 out of 10 times, 4 out of 10 alerts are going to be quote unquote false positives. All right, we've accepted that as consumers, but I'm telling you, why haven't we said, hey, wait a minute, if the product's wrong 4 out of 10 times,
yeah.
maybe, I'm just spitballing here, but maybe it's not, you know, fit for purpose. Maybe you're not ready for the market.
Right.
And that's the kind of consumer logic I just don't, you know, why are we sitting behind SOCs? Because you know what happens is what everybody talks about happens. SOC analysts are looking for, you know, 4 out of 10 are wrong, or they've got to investigate, so they stop monitoring. And they stop responding to him because, oh, that's probably another false positive. That's probably another false positive. I just checked that something like that the other day. It was a false positive. And so it's gotten to where like 1 out of 3 events identified in SOCs aren't investigated because there are, you know,
right.
could be a false positive. Meaning right. people are just tired of chasing down ghosts, you know, into rabbit holes because the products gives us false positives when it should just say intrusion, yes or no. It should be a binary call.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a guy on here a while ago. I actually had the pleasure of doing his talk as well. But he talked a lot about analyst fatigue and tying that to, you know, false positives and how you get these analysts who just are burnt out after 6 months because they spend their whole time running down, you know, these false positives. When you said that 4 out of 10 thing too, immediately I thought of, I don't know any gun that would do well selling if its claim to fame was that four out of 10 times you try to pull the trigger, the bullet won't go off. It's
yep.
not going to sell
then,
very
way,
well.
And by that, by the way, that's down in the last 5 years from 47%. And that's almost half.
Right.
And still we buy products that have a 40% margin of error. And that say that right up front. You sign a service level agreement that says you understand false positives. But I'm sorry, a false positive – then the name is right there in what they're calling it. False positive. Is it false? Is it positive? We don't know. Why don't you go look at it? Okay. Thanks for that help. You know,
yeah.
really appreciate it. But it's that kind of attitude that I don't think we demand. Here's where I'm going with this, Rory. We
mm-hmm.
don't demand better from our cybersecurity vendors and managed security service providers. And that's my lesson learned after 30 years. I look back and say, I wish we would have demanded more. I wish we would have sent that Coke back because it didn't have enough ice, or that because, you know, it wasn't Coke, it was something else. I just don't understand how we have allowed vendors to especially when year after year, and I heard this on one of your, on, in fact, a podcast from a guy that was on with you a couple of weeks ago. And he said, every single year we spend more money and every single year there's more breaches. What's wrong with that?
Right.
And this is what, and what's wrong with that is we, every time we have a breach, what do? We buy more products. And it's that circle. It's a hamster circle that we just keep on. That's what we do. Oh, we had a breach. Let's buy another product. Product doesn't work. We have another breach. And here's where I'm going with this. You know, to me, you look after any major breach that you know comes through WannaCry or you know a huge problem that you know comes through the. Look at our top security vendors, and all of them have significant share price increases. Mm-hmm. They make more money. And so this commercial, thing I told you about in terms of cybersecurity vendors profit from the insecurity of computing. What's wrong is they profit from breaches. Yeah. And when they should be profiting from, you know, from non-breaches, how is it that they make more money profiting from when our systems have been breached, when it should be just the opposite way around? Yeah. It should be. That's where the money should be. But it's not. It's absolutely not. We as consumers, we jerk our legs back and we automatically run out and buy more product. As soon as I have customers who have ransomware, their first thing is we need more malware. I'm saying, well, you had now anti-malware, you know? You don't need more. We all need better anti-malware is the answer to ransomware. And by the way, another really interesting statistic that gives you insight on our poor products is, did you know that I think it's like there are 43 common vulnerability exposures, 43 CVEs associated with 18 products, mm-hmm. from Microsoft to the SonicWall that are responsible for over 90% of the ransomware we've had in the last 5 years.
Wow.
So I'm saying there's 18 products with common vulnerabilities that have already been announced to everybody that we're not patching, that's responsible, that's being exploited to upload ransomware, and right. It's all through products, 90%. And yet we don't look at our vendors as part of the problem with ransomware is because, you know, it's poor. Our vendors don't even practice security by design.
Yeah. I mean, that statistic right there speaks for itself.
It's published by CERT, which is which does nothing but track common vulnerabilities in ransomware. And they're saying, right. Wait a minute, 18 products, and it's the products that you and I buy from Microsoft and Adobe to, you know, I'll send you this list separately. It's just eye opening because you think that's 90% of the ransomware that we've had in the last 5 years. That's attributed to vulnerabilities associated with products that we buy to secure our systems. How does that work?
So how do you think then we make this cybersecurity fight more prevalent to non-technical people then, to get them to understand this conundrum that we're in between products not doing what they say they claim to do and the user base just being okay with, you know, less than satisfactory?
I think we have to talk about the consumer is sound asleep. You know, to me, Rory, it's a lot like in my lifetime in the 70s, you jumped in cars and they didn't have seatbelts.
Right.
You know, and Detroit wasn't interested in putting any safety in cars because there's no money in it. And they weren't going to spend an extra dollar for a piece of canvas, you know, that goes and wraps up. But, you know, people were getting into accidents going 30 miles an hour and they're going through the windshield. And it took people like Ralph Nader, you know, a tireless activist for safety in automobiles to say enough is enough. Too many people are dying because, you know, and then suddenly consumers started to be attracted by, secure automobiles. Like I remember Volvo was the biggest, was the coolest, you know, because it was secure and and suddenly next thing you know, we had airbags and cars and shoulder harnesses and, you know, anti-lock brakes and shatterproof glass and, you know, everything is not, and now it's the norm. Right. Now it's the norm. It's the standard. But it took the consumers to say, hey, can we have a little safety in these automobiles? Anyway, that's what's missing in our industry. And for me, it's very personal. It starts with, you know, nobody's awake until they've had their phone broken into or their laptop broken into. And then suddenly it's, hey, are you kidding me? There's I thought I bought something to protect myself from this. Yep. So I tell my friends, I tell my family, you got to make it personal. You know, you got to make it personal because nobody's going to look out for you. Nobody's going to look out for the privacy of your data. Big companies aren't, you know, and your data has very intrinsic value. Your data is cash out there in today's, market. Mark Zuckerberg knows it. That's why he's a billionaire and you're not. You're, you know, whether where you where you've been, where you go, your geolocation, your likes, your dislike, what time you turned on your mobile, what time you turned it off. All of this is data equals cash. And right. that data is not protected. And so until it touches you and you go out and apply for a loan and you don't get it because somebody sold your data on Facebook, you know, to a loan company or to a healthcare provider. And on Facebook, you said that, you know, you've got a upper respiratory cough and you can't get, and you're living in a place where you can't get antibiotics. And then you go apply for health insurance and they tell you, oh, you're asthmatic. And you're like, no, I'm not. I don't smoke. I'm great health. And no, well, Mark Zuckerberg sold them your data that says that you're prone to upper respiratory system ailments. Until that happens to us, you as a person, me, or even a business, I don't think we take it very seriously. We keep buying crap that doesn't work. But I don't, honestly, I talk to my clients who've had breaches and I say, right here, we do forensic investigation and say, came in through this port right here. And that port shouldn't have taken that traffic. In fact, it says right here in your SLA that they were supposed to be, and they bought a managed service that port should have been monitored and somebody should have picked that up, and it's all gone. And at the end of the day, the client refuses, just doesn't go back to the vendor and say it didn't work. It was crap. Now, part of this is the service level agreements that we all sign, just right. like we click, you know, and we accept the terms of the vendors. But I tell you, all you have to do is not sign it and or write on the bottom, and if I have a breach, you'll be responsible. Send that back and see how quickly your vendor calls you and says, we can't accept this SLA. And then ask yourself, why is that? Mm. Why wouldn't they accept accountability or liability if their product is involved or responsible for a breach? And that should say everything. It should tell you, you just bought a flat screen TV that doesn't work, my friend. Right. And until you start asking for more, until you start expecting more, then asking it, and then just maybe the vendors will start to, like Volvo did, and become, you know, hey, maybe it's a secure internet service provider can make a lot of money out there. I'm all over the map on this, Rory, because I think it's consumer awareness issue, but and the consumers I talk to are those technical geeks who understand how a firewall works, anti-malware scripting, you know, and I can't get them to say, wait a minute, is it malware or not? Right. If it is, you know it is, and shouldn't the product have addressed that? Yes, it should have. Well, then pick up the phone and call the vendor and see what they have to say, because if you don't call them, they're out there, you know, and if they say, no, I'm sorry, we don't cover that, then say, okay, well, wait a minute. But I tell you, I'm an American. I'm living over in London, and I always, you know, for me, the Americans are a very litigious group, and I think it might take a lawsuit or two. Say, I bought this firewall from you, and I still had a breach. I'd like my money back, and I'd like to sue you because I had ransomware that took my business down, and you were responsible for it.
Right.
I don't know why. All I try to tell everybody is, or tell my friends, my family, and the businesses that I consult to, are you got to take this personal. You have to take it personal, because it is. This is our personal data being taken from us by right. nation states, by cyber criminals. This is data about you know, people's husbands, their wives, their mothers, their fathers, their grandmothers, their granddaughters. This is medical data. This is, you know, DNA, for crying out. It doesn't get any more personal than that. How, it's not ones and zeros. How do we not see this as a very personal thing that can have a profound effect on our privacy and the rest of our lives? Because that data, whether it's stolen or monetized by a bona fide company, is being, you know, can have a detrimental effect, a real detrimental effect on your life. Once you've lost your personal data, can, you know, our DNA is out there being sold by ancestry.com, you know, or anybody right. who uses those kind of look up my family tree for free. Yeah. What's for free is give us some DNA. Yeah. You know, two generations from now, when your great grandkids can't go to school because they have the wrong DNA, you're going to think, oh, geez, you should have protected that DNA.
Yeah. I mean, all those points you make are definitely things I've thought about myself, and I think everyone needs to think about. You know, it's nothing is ever for free, especially when it comes to cyber. And, you know, maybe with cybersecurity, cybercrime, it's the biggest advantage to the criminals is that they're so anonymous, right? You can't point to someone and say that guy stole this from me or that guy took this from me. And, you know, maybe that's what weighs on the consumer mind, that kind of it's hard for you to want to go after someone because you don't know who to go after to begin with. But they need to get over that hump. And I think it definitely starts with holding vendors accountable, you know, or the people who you give your data to, right?
That's right. There's two things. We're having two conversations. The vendors who are supposed to be, we're buying products from to protect that data, right, and the companies that have lost that data. All right. So in both as an end user and yeah, you're right. 9 times out of 10, we don't know that Mark Zuckerberg has lost our data or sold it, you know, either or, because we're not connected. But when we do find out, it's too late. And it's like you were sleepwalking through this lifetime with the things that we let go without question, whether I'm giving you my data, Amazon. Now what you do with it, you know, I'm trusting you, and that trust is, you know, who cares? You can trust Jeff Bezos, or you can trust him to turn your data into cash, which is what he does. But you give it to somebody else, to momandpop.com, who are selling flowers on the internet. And you're saying, well, okay, they're just what kind of flowers I have, but it's also the birthday of your grandmother in there, because, and her address and her whatever other, you know, and your credit card and all this other data. And they have a breach, and the cyber criminal takes that from you. And you suddenly find your grandmother gets, you know, identity theft. It has a profound impact on her life. It's personal. It's not ones and zeros. And it seems to me, when it is that personal, we should be demanding more from the companies that we give our data to protect it, and the companies that we buy products to protect that data to, if we're that business. But we're not. We're letting down our customers by not sending back our firewalls that get breached, is my point. There's a balance in between there, because the customers who are buying these security products, and the products don't work, and they're losing data, and they're breaching the trust of the customers who gave them that data. I'm giving you my grandmother's home address and her birthday. It might not be that important to you, but you know, it might be important to grandma.
Right,
but that's just missing that common sense. You know, I don't know. I get really worried when I see how much data that we give away, and I also get really worried when I talk to businesses and they don't care. It's ones and zeros. It's just some grandma's birthdays, and they don't see it as data about people's lives. Period. And you know, I'll tell you one story real quick. I'm in London, and every couple of months I sit and I there's a guy I meet with, and he's a vendor for the largest firewall vendor in the UK, in the United Kingdom. Okay. And I meet with him, and one day he comes in. We have lunch every couple of months, and one day I come in and he's late, and he walks in and he's beet red. He's all upset. I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Somebody hacked into my laptop." And I went, "Oh, don't you use one of those newfangled firewalls that you sell?" And I'm making fun of him, you know, but he's mad.
Right.
I said, "No, really, what is it?" And he said, "Somebody took pictures of my family at the beach." So now it's personal. This is a guy who sells firewall products for a living. All right. Mm-hmm. He turns a nice living selling security products. But now it's somebody had the audacity to go through his firewall and take pictures of his family. So somebody around the world is looking at pictures of his wife and his kids on a beach somewhere. And now he's upset. Right. And I'm thinking, how can you sell security products and be that disconnected from the effects of a breach? But, you know, until it was personal to him, and he's still upset about it to this day. And it's that kind of disconnect that I think our vendors have about the importance of selling us something that actually works, and that businesses have about protecting people's data, because it is personal. Yeah. It doesn't get any more personal than this. I mean, you can send your Coke back for too much ice or too much, you know, but you're engaged in a quest for quality there in that transaction, right? I want the right ice in my Coke. I want a flat screen TV to work. That's all I'm advocating, that we cross that line to just start asking for more and expecting more. Yeah. And then without that, we're never going to change the industry. And 20 years from now, there'll be other podcasts on the crap cybersecurity products. we all have high hopes for AI. You know, AI is going to save us. Is it really? Has any technology saved us? from a technology problem in cybersecurity. You know, cybersecurity has always been a bolt-on in my 30 years, you know, no matter what it was. I remember Bluetooth, you know, insecure, Wi-Fi, 802, insecure, you know, cloud, insecure, technology first, security second. And suddenly AI comes along and you think, wow, it could be used for good. It could be used for evil. And if you don't think it's being used for evil right now, you just don't understand how, you know, cyber criminals work.
Yeah. Well, I know you talk about cybercrime.com and the org chart. What is that? Can you dive into that a little bit for me?
Yeah, cyber. Well, I don't. For me, what I see, what I'll dive into you for is just this awareness of how sophisticated cybercrime is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all think it is, we all know it is, but we don't understand cybercrime today as a business. There's two threat actors out there who've changed the landscape completely. One, nation states.
Yeah.
Nation states, you just can't compete against them. A nation state puts its resources against your business. You just throw up your hands. It's you can't fight that. It's like that. Remember Crocodile Dundee when he's walking across the park with his girlfriend and some kids jump out and she says, Mick, give him your wallet. He's got a knife. He said, that's not a knife. This is a knife. And he pulls out the big knife. That's nation states on the threat landscape. You know, they their resources, their capability just dwarfs anybody out there. Yeah. And I always thought it always would be. It's like, you know, they play on a completely different level. Not so much these days because organized cyber crime gangs have increasingly upped the ante. It is now people think of it like, you know, some, you know, Russian mafia. And they are. But the first cyber crime about 3 or 4 years ago, I was at a conference in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, here, let me introduce you to, and they gave me his name. And he was a journalist who investigated cyber crime. And I started walking, and he said, and he's whispering in my ear, he said, this guy right here, he's probably the third highest cyber crime criminal in the world. And I'm walking over to him, and he's in a three-piece suit. And he opens up his mouth and he talks to me with an English accent that could cut glass. And he's got shoes that are, you know, are worth more than my car. And he is one of the most, and I sit down with him and have a pleasant glass of red wine as we discuss, you know, the cybersecurity threat landscape out there. And I'm thinking, well, he's one of the biggest players out there. And he's running one of the biggest organized cyber crime groups out there. The point is that these things are more sophisticated in terms of structure. They have a CEO, they have a CFO, a funding officer, they have an HR officer, they have a marketing department, they have a sales department who sells all the commoditized ransomware as a service. They are more structured than my business. I run a business, you know, and for 90% of the businesses that I talk to, and their business is hacking. Their business is to hack into your business, and they make money at it. Yeah. They say crime pays, but organized crime pays a lot more. and their business model is hacking into your business. And that's what we just don't connect the dots. We just think, oh, they're cyber criminals. They're out there, you know, grabbing grandma's identity and trying to, you know, do some identity theft. No. They're targeted. The things that they target and the structure that they have, you know, that the average C-level what would be a C level, like a CFO level in an organized crime gang, makes about $15 million US dollars annually.
Wow.
A mid-level manager, all right? People will go out there like an HR manager who's recruiting coders to code new ransomware, things like that. They make about $5 million US. And a coder, just somebody writing code, makes about $1 million US a year. Big money. Now, I don't know of a coder, anybody who's working at a bank and developing, you know, a web app, a transactional application, who's making £1 million a year.
Right.
The difference, and they can pay that because you can imagine they, you know, when they invest, they get a return on that investment. And so this is a business that's out to hack other businesses, and they are very good at what they do. And it's that misconception. You know, over 70% of organized cyber crime, cyber criminals, quote unquote, are over 40 years old.
Wow.
Over 40 years old. And they're making, you know, $1 million annual salaries. Low risk, high reward. It doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah.
It used to be that once upon a time, they said 2 out of 10 hackers worked for organized crime groups. it's the opposite now. 8 out of 10 work for organized crime. They have all consolidated and they've understand this is where the money's at. And yet on the threat landscape, we still have this perception like there are a couple of kids, you know, sitting in their basement eating pizza, hopped up on Red Bull, trying to infect a bank with ransomware. No, not at all. Extremely. These guys have, you know, 24/7 help centers. They have, you know, terms and conditions for using ransomware that they're selling to kids, you know, with Red Bull, who are hopped up on Red Bull. They have user manuals for the ransomware that they sell. They have, you know, and like I said, help centers if you have a problem with it. Right. They guarantee 100% money back guarantee, you know, for the malware that they sell. It's just this is a business that is we underestimate. We're going on, you know, everybody's idea of cybercrime gangs 10, 20 years ago. That's not what the landscape looks like today. The landscape looks like today is they're wearing three-piece suits and, you know, internationally with offshore accounts and move money like, you know, Citibank wishes they could move money.
Yeah. So how did it get here then? You know, if it started out as this idea of like, you know, kids in their basements hacking grandma's account, when did it really become, okay, you know what, this isn't just that, this is a profitable business. When do you think that kind of switch took place?
Well, it's been switching slowly by the commoditization of, you know, you can buy denial of service credits now. You can buy, you know, look at ransomware. Have you ever been to a ransomware? If you've ever had ransomware, you know, they'll take you to a place on the dark web with, you know, that says they'll show you proof of life. So this is, yes, we've got, you know, and it's like going through an Amazon checkout. You literally have a cart that says, you know, put your key, you know, to decode here for proof of life, see here. And even at the end of it, it comes to, I remember 5 years ago, I saw this when I was first paying off ransomware for a client who asked us to do that. And we did it. And I was just shocked. I'm on the dark web on some guy's website. And, you know, we paid him for proof of life. He gave it to us. The customer paid, got the decryption key back. He decrypted all of it. And he said, okay, thanks very much. Could you rate our service? Five stars, please. I'm not kidding. It is. They adopted the e-commerce model that everybody uses. That's all right. Unreal. Because of course, what they want is they want a good reputation. Yeah. If we give you ransomware, we'll give you that decryption key. And so, literally, could you please leave us a review? Was it a pain? You know, was it a pain to process your decryption? Would you recommend us? Would you recommend if somebody got infected? Would you recommend that they pay us? And that was 5 years ago, Rory. And wow. So with the commoditization, you know, suddenly the dark net is moving just like Silicon Valley, and they're adopting the same principles of e-commerce against hacking. Okay, now you put so when that started, and of course that gave volume, that gave kids, you know, hopped up on Red Bull eating pizza, that suddenly gave them access to top of the line zero day vulnerabilities, top of the line ransomware, you know, that was and then it became a question of cyber criminal gangs getting into the distribution of commoditized, you know, weapons like ransomware. Who gave it a worldwide view. And that's why ransomware took off so much, because it was all commoditized. Yeah. It wasn't the cyber criminal gangs who were actually, they wouldn't go to the length of trying to infect somebody with ransomware. They'll just sell that ransomware kit to a hacker who's looking to make some cash and put himself through college. And that's it. And right. That's big money. That's big. There's more money in the distribution of hacking tools. So that was the evolution. It wasn't that they were doing, you know, large scale identity theft. They were selling identity theft, you know, tools to kids.
Yeah.
Who were able to, you know, who script kiddies and hacktivists who were able to up their game, because suddenly they have tools like, you know, like this is a knife. They had some, they weren't writing, you know, funky scripts and trying to do phishing, you know, No, it upped the sophistication of the whole market. And then the cyber criminal gangs that were able to move on that level, all they're doing now is distributing and the things that they distribute in waves. And they're, you know, that I don't know what's next. It's they'll move wherever the market goes.
Right.
I'm looking at if to see if there's one or two, like the Jeff Bezos, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Elon Musks of the cyber criminal world. There's not that. I wouldn't say there's three, but I think it's getting under 50, as I see it. It's certainly, top 20. I keep hearing the same names more and more. It's a consolidation of the market place. And as long as we have an unregulated, deep web, they've got a place to sell it.
Right. All right. So any, what would you leave with any business owner who really wanted to kind of take the first step to become more educated and what they could do to protect their business? What would you leave them with?
I'd say, I sell pen testing for a living, Rory. I told you this, and I'm amazed that people pay us to do what they should be doing themselves, is get in touch with your inner hacker. Try to hack your own business before you hire somebody to do a pen test on it. You don't know how to hack? Hacking's easy. There's three things. All hacking boils down to three objectives. Change configuration, upload a program, or get physical access to what? Change configuration or upload a program. That's it. All hacking comes down to those three objectives. Every single hacker on the planet, every hack you and I have ever read about, is about can you change configuration of the target system? Can you upload a program to that target system? And if not, can you get physical access to do one or the other? So when I go into a client and I said, "Have you done any pen testing?" He goes, "No, oh, I'm hiring you to do that." I said, "No. Have you tried to break into your own systems? It's like before you go out to find somebody to physically secure your house. Have you walked around and say, if I was going to break into my house, I'd come in through this window, I'd kick this down, there's no alarm there. And have you done that?" So take a good look at your own house before you hire somebody to come in and break into it, because they're going to come right through they're going to break a window or come through a door or something obvious, and they're going to give you the short answer to that. So I try to tell people, get in touch with your inner hacker, whether on a personal level. Try to hack your own device. Try to hack your mobile phone, hack your laptop. You don't know where to start? Go to Google and type in how to hack in and then type in a flat screen TV. How to hack a Wi-Fi connection. How to hack my mobile and put in your mobile device. Start right there. And if you're too lazy, go to YouTube and see a video on it. Just do the minimum. Do the minimum. Go to Google to hack in. You got a firewall, put your firewall's name in and say, "How do I hack a XX firewall?" And get the vulnerabilities associated with that and fix them. Do that yourself. But before you do, try to hack into it. Try to find that vulnerability and exploit it and get that tactical sense of how easy it is. Because all the money we're talking about is because, as for these reasons that products don't seem to work, and we're not getting us rolling up our sleeves and doing, and trying to break into our own system so we understand how easy that is for somebody else with skills, experience, and tools. So make it personal. I'd end on do it yourself. Get in touch with your inner hacker. And then, because you'll shock yourself, you're saying, "Well, geez, we're wide open." You work for a large company, type in, go to the dark web and say, "Has anybody broke into?" and type in the name of your company and see what they say. Because I've been there. Here's how to do it, and give you step-by-step instructions. It's all out there. There's knowledge transfer. You don't have to be a, you know, have to. Nobody goes to ethical ha nobody on the dark side. Nobody puts themselves through an ethical hacking school, and that, it's not like that. They're just all self-taught, because the knowledge is all out there. So at least roll up your sleeves and figure to show yourself how easy it is, because you would take a different perspective of the problem if you did.
I think that's great advice. I think that's something that all people needed to probably hear, and especially business owners, to know that they're able to do that, to get in there and try it themselves. Any books, events, upcoming talks, or anything that you'd like to plug our listeners to?
Thanks, Rory. No, I'm on the circuit. I'm speaking a lot. If you go to our website, I would, because a lot of what we've been talking about, we recently wrote a paper called "How the Cybersecurity Industry Has Failed: The Circle of Failure." It's about a 20-page white paper, and it goes through all the different elements. And in there's a checklist of things that we can all do to start improving our industry. And I would say, if you went to riskcrew.com, you could download that paper if you're interested in some of the things that we talked about today. It's If you want to get involved, it's got an action checklist of things you can actually do.
Perfect. Okay, then we'll link your website and urge our listeners and subscribers to go check that out. But this has been great for me. Very, very insightful. So thank you for your time.
No, thank you, Rory. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.